Accession number 21095, Reel 2.
Hello, Pick. Reel 2. I wonder if I could ask you a little more about the Chorley household, this sort of intellectual, relatively affluent family, you say.
Yes, well, they had this house in Stanmore, which I think I got to know before we went up to the Lake District. They were from the beginning very, very nice to me and welcomed me. I don't know whether there was a question of my going to live with my mother in Stanmore, because it was all to this was just I suppose 2 or 3 weeks before they were going up to the Lake District anyway, and how things would have worked out if the war hadn't broken out, obviously, is one doesn't know. But you know, the Chorleys still laugh about it now, but it really was that Theo Chorley, Professor Chorley, just loved Apfelstrudel, and when and they had lost their cook, and were looking for a new cook, and when they discovered that, you know, here was this Austrian who knew how to make Apfelstrudel, she had the job. And they always joked about this forever afterwards. But they liked her, and they treated her as an equal, not as a servant. And as I say, then they were going up to the Lake District for the month of August, and they invited me to come with her, and you know, I just remember a very happy summer up in their house in the Lake District, walking. We found some old films that somebody must have taken at that time, with us climbing climbing the hills in the Lake District, all of us with rucksacks on our back and sort of. Anyway, and I've seen this film. It's quite fun because there we all were, again, Theo Chorley and his wife Catherine and their three children, two sons and a daughter, and I think my mother and myself all enjoying ourselves up there. And I still remember that in those days my mother was forever, whenever she saw bracken, picking bracken, and they kept on saying to her, "What for?" You know, and she thought it was some rare flower, because you don't see it in Austria at all. And it was only later that, you know, she finally realized that it was really a weed that grew everywhere in the Lake District. But then, when it was clear that war was going to break out, they discussed what to do with everybody. And there was no question they were going back to London to join the war effort. They sent their two sons to boarding schools, and they put their daughter Gillian into a school in Ambleside in the Lake District called the Fairfield PNEU School. PNEU stands for Parents National Educational Union. And this school was attached to the teacher training college for this system of teaching, something called the Charlotte Mason College, because Charlotte Mason had been the founder of it. And the whole point behind that school was it was really a network established particularly to help children of colonial civil servants and diplomats abroad, so that they could all work to the same syllabus. And if they were just isolated, they would just get the syllabuses from the Charlotte Mason College, and they would do their work, and at the end of term, send the work back, and so on and so forth. But the system also had a number of schools. Fairfield was the teacher training school, really, though it had, of course, its team of full-time trained teachers. And then it had a couple of boarding schools in England. And Gillian, the daughter, actually only spent one term at Fairfield and then went to one of the PNEU boarding schools. But this school offered me a free place, which, of course, was a huge help at the time. My mother wanted to stay in the Lake District, and they thought that was a sensible thing to do. And at first, she found a job with a wonderful elderly, well, she was a widow, called Mrs. Delmar Banner, who had a beautiful house above Dove Cottage in Grasmere. Dove Cottage, where it was Dove Cottage. And we moved over to that house, and she adopted me as if I was her granddaughter. And she really, and my mother was extremely happy. She was a wonderful person. And she promised that, she said that, you know, she would look after us as long as she was alive, we had a home there, and so on and so forth. Only unfortunately, she died about 6 or 7 months after the war broke out. And then my mother again had to find somewhere to live and work. And that was when she went to this other family who had, again, the most beautiful house right on the shores of Lake Windermere, with a long driveway in from the main road and large gardens, very big house with a sort of servant's wing. And their name was Anderson, and they had connections with Argentina, and in some respects that was very fortunate, because throughout the war they were getting food parcels from Argentina, so that there was always, I'm sure, more food in that house, and sort of things like butter and so on than we would have had under normal circumstances. But they treated my mother really as their servant, as their cook, and we were confined to this servant's wing. I mean, you know, it was perfectly adequate, you know, that we had two rooms and bathroom and so on, but basically it was the kitchen plus the bedrooms, and it was always made quite clear to me that I was not would not be allowed to walk into the main part of the house, and that I, you know, the garden was not my playing field, though they did let me. They had no objections to my sort of streaking across the lawns down to the lake to swim, because they never swam, and so they didn't use that part of the garden. But that was the way, and I bicycled to school every day, and had one very good friend. I mean, most of the children in that school were boarders, and there were just a few day children. One of them became a very close friend, and she was the only one that I ever invited to the house, because I just couldn't bear to think that anyone else would know about the way. I mean, that you know, was a serious problem for me, that I didn't want anyone to know how I lived. I became a girl guide in the school, and became the company leader in some later stages. I still remember, I was quite a large girl, and I still remember there was one occasion when we did some kind of a play in Ambleside Church about African chiefs being converted to Christianity. And I was an African chief, and I had to be painted all over with liquid stocking to make me look dark. I mean, things like that I remember very well. but I was happy at school. The school was a very good school in the arts, totally devoid of any serious teaching of science. It had no labs, nothing, and my ignorance on scientific subjects has never left me, because I never had a real start in any. You know, we did a bit of biology, but the one thing that we did do a lot, and which was, we used to go for walks where, and we had to keep nature notebooks and record the first flowers of the year. I mean, the first time we saw any flower bloom, we had to draw them and paint them. Same went for birds. That was fine. But when it came to real science, no, there was nothing. But we read a lot of Shakespeare. We acted. I mean, we read it out. We didn't act it out, but we did play it out. And during the school holidays, we were always set certain books that we had to read during the holidays, and so on. So from that point of view, it was a very good grounding. but it was a very one-sided education. I had some very good teachers who took a lot of interest in me, and one of the things that had happened was that I had, I think from the word go, refused to speak any German, and my mother tried to force me into German by speaking German to me, though she spoke good, she learned English quickly and learned it well. But I would always reply in English, and I would get absolutely furious, but really furious, if she spoke German anywhere outside where there were other people present, or even just passers-by in the street. I just sort of say, shut up and don't do this, and it really infuriated me. And then one of the teachers in the school, who was, amongst other things, some German language teacher, a man with whom I obviously had a crush, took me on one side, but by that time I was 14 or 15, and said, look, this is just not on, and for my sake, do it. And then sort of slowly I went back into German, but it took a long time. And I mean, by the same token, you would never have been able to persuade me to acknowledge that I was Jewish to anybody, or tell anyone that I was Jewish. And I started going to church in Grasmere. I'm not quite sure how I came to know, I mean, because we'd been in Grasmere for a while, I think, my mother got to know people in Grasmere, and there were quite a number of refugees in the Lake District throughout the war, and some of them got to know each other, and in particular, one of the things I remember is there were a number of musicians in the Lake District, and they formed a quartet, and one of the people in there, amongst them, was Hans Keller, who later became head of music at the BBC and so on, and they all met, and I think amongst them there were a couple who were in Grasmere, and I think they knew the Heaton Coopers. And now Heaton Cooper he's dead now, but he was one of the better known Lakeland painters. His father had already been a painter, and he painted the Lake District landscapes, and he was married to someone called Ophelia Bell, was her maiden name. She was a well-known sculptress, and they had become members of Moral Rearmament. And when I got to know them, I think the first thing that happened is that they sort of introduced me to Grasmere Church, and I just loved going to church services in Grasmere. I think at the time they had a vicar that I also liked, but I used to drag my mother there on Sunday evenings to go to church. I don't think I had any deep religious feelings, but if I had any feelings at all, they would have been Church of England, and certainly not Jewish. And then I got totally intrigued by this Moral Rearmament, and one of the things that they did is that they would sit down in the morning and in silence and let God speak to them and tell them what they had to do for the rest of the day and things like that. And I thought this was just marvelous. How could this happen? And they were lovely to me, and they tolerated me, and I used to help. They lived in a small house attached to their studio. Well, it was called the studio, right in the middle of Grasmere. The studio was in fact a small exhibition hall where people would come in and buy framed prints on postcards and so on. And I started helping with the framing of these prints and so tried to be helpful and so on. But I spent an awful lot of time there, and they never minded it. And they started having their own children. I remember their first daughter being born, and I was just there. One of their sons has now also become an artist, and I see them whenever I'm up in the Lake District, and he's a wonderful painter, and I now own some of his paintings. But he certainly discarded moral rearmament. But as Ophelia unfortunately died of a brain tumor when she was still relatively young, but Heaton lived on until he was 85. And he never left moral rearmament. He stayed with it, and I think they tried very hard in the end to convince me that that was a way of life for me too. And they introduced me to their friends, and once they even took me to their headquarters in Switzerland. But I knew that it was not for me, and I also, you know, gradually came to think that a lot of it was hypocrisy, and not in their case. I think in their case it was really deeply felt.
Could you tell me more about it, moral rearmament, and what this sort of movement stood for?
I think the movement just stood and still stands. It still exists for this belief that, you know, if you just listen to God, God will tell you exactly how you should behave and what you should do, and would advise you on all sorts of very material things. It also expected you to lead a fairly, to live by a code of conduct and certain that there was nothing outside marriage. If you strayed in any way away from your family or your wife, that was mortal. Well, not mortal sin, but anyway, that you then no longer deserved to be a member of the moral rearmament. I think there were a lot of financial issues involved, and as you know, I mean, moral rearmament today is hardly known and is no longer considered to be a dangerous sort of religious movement. But at the time, I think it was seen much as, for instance, the Moonies or Christian Scientology is seen today as a movement that really persuaded people to part with their money, and certainly they were expected to give part of their income to moral rearmament. But I think at the time it was seen as something that really tried to take money from people and to exercise influence without showing what return there was in terms of spiritual well-being. But at the same time, certainly from what I saw from the Heaton Coopers and from their friends, I mean, there were very many people, maybe they were just credulous, but I mean, who certainly believed that this was a way of life that suited them and that other people ought to adopt, and who did not feel exploited by it. But I think the people who were close to the top of the hierarchy there probably were fairly ambiguous in terms of what they were doing.
So it wasn't for you. You knew it wasn't for you.
It wasn't for me, but I think I always knew that, in a way, that religion wasn't for me. I've always envied people who can truly believe, because I think it's a wonderful thing if you have belief. But I don't have belief. But I still get some kind of feeling of well-being of going to church services, for instance. And again, you know, that's a sort of ambiguous thing that I do. But whenever I'm in Vienna on a Sunday, I always go to one of the churches in Vienna, because I mean, they have the most wonderful song. I mean, they always sing masses in Vienna. You know, you really go to a free concert. But I still like the atmosphere as well. So it's a double-edged feeling. But I very, very rarely go to synagogues, and have really get nothing out of it. And you know, in many ways, I regret that I don't have much of what I would call Jewish culture, because I certainly didn't get it from my mother. And later, I never had sufficient interest in it. Now, I think it's a lack. You know, something. You know, after all, I had the opportunity to have it, and I don't. But I have always had a real dislike of orthodoxy and of, although I know the logic of kosher eating, I still think that in this day and age, it is an unnecessary thing to do, and in a way a burden in people's lives to do it. And you know, this whole business of just shutting down on Friday evenings and theoretically not turning on anything that's electrical and then waiting until Saturday, to me is meaningless. I feel, you know, sometimes I think of the Jews who do it, it's sort of that they go into hospital on a Friday night and come out of hospital again on Saturday night, which it's wrong, I know. Almost the only thing that I really do enjoy and I like to keep if I'm invited is to go on Passover to the Seder evening, which has a really enjoyable ritual attached to it. But that's about the only form of religious manifestation, Jewish manifestation, that I, you know, am quite pleased to participate in. So that doesn't say much for me, I think. But I think it really was that my mother had turned against orthodoxy so strongly that she, I don't think she knew very much of Jewish culture either. I mean, she'd never lived in that kind of setting except during the period while she was married, and then I suppose very much in the margins too. And I have never really, and then certainly in England, she made no attempt to say to me, you know, it's about time to learn more about Jewish culture and not just about, you know, I happily went to the sort of Bible classes at school, many parents have not allowed Jewish parents have not allowed their children to participate. I did, you know, we every morning we sang hymns, I knew every hymn and this kind of thing. This was all part of my life, and there was certainly no attempt by my mother to prevent me from doing all of that. And I enjoyed it, I think. But again, without really feeling that I believe in any true sense.
I suppose you and your mother, you know, you were thrown very closely together at this time. Did you become very close? You know, did you sort of lean on each other a lot in these circumstances?
I think at that time, while I was at school, we were very close. Yes, of course, you know, she had no other outlet for her emotions at all, really, and I think... at that point, she was making no demands on my emotions. I mean, it was, I think, quite reciprocal, because I needed some backbone other than the school, and she certainly didn't interfere with, she didn't try to stop me from spending so much time at the Heaton Coopers. I don't know how she felt about it. I mean, she liked them too. I mean, she's, they were friends, but they were not half as close to them, obviously, as I was. But that created no tensions of any sort. But I mean, the one thing is that I was growing up all that time in a purely female society. I mean, there were just no men around. These odd refugees, but they were just real sort of. Occasional encounters, but there was, I suppose, the only man who had any kind of influence on me must have been that teacher who persuaded me to learn English again, German again. But there were no men or even boys of my age. There wasn't, because the girl was a girls' school. The teachers were, with one or two exceptions, women. My friends were obviously only. I had no friends outside the school. They were girls. Their brothers didn't appear on the scene because they were mostly boarders, and this one really close friend that I had didn't have a brother. She was also an only child. So no boys, and I think that did retard my development. I'm absolutely convinced of that. But it was a very curious environment. And I think one of the things I should mention is that, of course, every refugee, we had no passports, but we had some kind of identity papers, but they marked us out as enemy aliens. And the curious thing was that we were in Westmorland, Cumbria then was still divided into different counties, and we were in Westmorland. The other side of Lake Windermere was Lancashire. In Lancashire, not that far from Lake Windermere, there was a prisoner of war camp. So that the whole area over there was a restricted area, and in theory, and I think the Chorleys were still coming back there from time to time, certainly during the school holidays. And whenever they were there, obviously wanted to go across to see them. And in theory, you had to go to the police station in Ambleside to get a permit to go over into this restricted area in Lancashire. And so I remember doing that from time to time, but there was a boat, the house where my mother was working, they had a boat which she was allowed to use. And so from time to time, we would row across without permission, so that's great sort of violent, doing illegal acts, but that that was very, very curious. And see, we were there for the whole of the war, and because that part of the world was really not touched by the war, there were no bombs, I did lead an extraordinarily sheltered life there. We read newspapers, obviously, and knew what was going on, but it was all distant, and it was really unusual. And so the life was sheltered and peaceful, and did a lot of walking, a lot of swimming, skating in the winter, a lot with my mother. My mother was a great swimmer. We used to swim across Lake Lake Grasmere, for example. Went skating in the winter, and from that point of view, it was an ideal childhood. Yes, well, as a in my girl guide mode, I think it must have been the summer. We went, our little company went camping in the Lake District, and we camped in a field that was part of the farm that belonged to Beatrix Potter, the children's writer. And it was poor, it was typical, well, because Lake District actually has a lot more good weather than bad weather, but at that time it was pouring with rain, and we were really washed out, virtually washed out from our tents. And I think the sort of bedraggled group, she invited us to come to her house and sort of and gave us cups of tea and sort of just generally made us feel cared for before we went back to our rain-soaked tents. But I do remember this rather comfortable woman there and just being very, very nice to us. And I think I got a thrill out of it, but I hope so anyway.